First, let me begin by thanking Professor Deborah McDowell for organizing this symposium, for her leadership at the Woodson Institute, and I think for providing us with a model of what it means to do relevant scholarship that not only engages the academy, but engages the larger world. Exactly 40 years ago, when queried about the purpose of education, one of the foundational figures in African American studies, Nathan Hare, argued that any academic unit not concerned with addressing critical political issues is gravely irrelevant. And so in this moment in time, it's extremely important and it's beneficial to have leadership that understands this important aspect of the Black Studies tradition. Today, in a very short period of time, I would like to confront and discuss the NAACP's legacy in the South, as well as challenge me in doing this about the organization. Forgive me in advance for throwing all pretense of objective analysis out the window, but this is a paper with ideological or regional axes to grind. But before I get into that, let me first explain why I think it's so important for us to engage the South. First, engaging the South provides us with the opportunity to challenge one of the most enduring myths of the NAACP. And that is that the organization is a civil rights organization, as Harlem Radical Hubert Harrison once noted, was only concerned about the advancement of certain people, particularly the Black elite. In many ways, the genealogical roots of contemporary arguments about the NAACP as disinterested in issues concerning the folk, working class people, goes back to the World War I era, a period when many members of the Black left posited the idea that the NAACP had no connection to the masses. Contrary to suggestions by the radical Black left that the NAACP was invariably out of touch with both the desires and the needs of the folk, the Noted Civil Rights Organization was not exclusively concerned with protecting the interests of the middle class. Nor was the NAACP invariably opposed to challenging the power of capital, nationally and locally. Its leaders incorporated leftist critiques into their political analyses, mediated arguments between Black workers and white organized labor, initiated grassroots struggles against discriminatory employers, and pursued numerous legal battles on behalf of aggrieved Black workers. Moreover, the organization would play a crucial role in democratizing the Black public sphere. Thus, hundreds of ordinary Black folk in the South, thousands of ordinary Black folk in the South, identified the NAACP as an important ally in their protracted struggle for social justice. Engaging the NAACP is also important for another reason. Engaging its critical role in the nationalization of the Black freedom struggle. Trans-regional networks provided by the NAACP, developed by the NAACP during the crucible of political struggle, figured important in the development of a national identity among African Americans. More than simply channeling political dissent, the NAACP also contributed to a growing nationalist sensibility among African Americans across the country, particularly in the South. Feelings of connectedness and political obligation deepened significantly during the Negro era as organizations and conventions and media outlets affiliated with the NAACP brought people together in new and different ways. It was through the engagement with the NAACP that Black Southerners increasingly identified themselves as national subjects. and perform that subjectivity in ways that reflect their unique understanding of race and class in their individual and collective lives. So not simply the rhetorical, but the organizational strategies of the NAACP and blacks involved in the NAACP assisted in many ways in the creation of what literary scholar Houston Baker identifies as a vocabulary of national possibilities. Lastly, an analysis of the NAACP's early years in the South brings critical attention to the organization's role as a facilitator of intergenerational exchange among older African Americans and new Negro African American youth. In many ways, the most appropriate starting point for any story of the NAACP's expansion in the South is 1917, the year James Weldon Johnson agreed to become field secretary of the NAACP. Foremost on Johnson's agenda was building the NAACP's influence in the South. Committed to expanding the organization's influence beyond the urban North, the Notice of Civil Rights activists spent a considerable amount of time in the Jim Crow South, delivering mesmerizing political speeches, organizing new NAACP branches, and energizing dormant ones. A native of the South, a native of my hometown, Jacksonville, Florida, who had moved to New York City in 1902, Johnson recognized the personal risks involved in proselytizing the NAACP's message below the Mason-Dixon line. Nevertheless, he was fully convinced that the political situation in the South necessitated such personal sacrifice. If the NAACP was to realize its full potential as a catalyst for social change, the organization, Johnson insisted, would have to establish itself in the belly of America's racial beast. Much to the delight of a respected civil rights leader, thousands of black Southerners embraced his regional perspective and political commitments. On his many visits to the South, Johnson discovered women and men elated over the opportunity to organize NAACP branches in their respective communities. Such an enthusiastic response from black Southerners deepened Johnson's faith in the possibility of societal change in his lifetime. He wrote to Du Bois, "I am not only gratified by the campaign in the South, but I have been encouraged and inspired by it." Johnson's elation was certainly understandable. No longer confined to the liberal circles of the urban North, the NAACP had become a political player in the region that 90% of black Americans still called home. Vibrant branches would dot the southern landscape of Richmond, Virginia to Key West, Florida. When the NAACP released its annual report at the end of 1917, the association proudly boasted 80 branches and more than 10,000 members in the South. An eclectic group, Southern supporters of the civil rights organization included social elites and common laborers, native-born blacks and West Indian immigrants, political novices, and seasoned activists. A great pride for NAACP leaders in New York was the fact that Southern chapters were not only swelling in numbers, but engaging in significant political work that challenged entrenched patterns of power and privilege at the local, regional, and national level. Evidence of this challenge can be seen in two cities that I want to discuss really briefly, Charleston, South Carolina, and Key West, Florida. In Charleston, South Carolina in 1917, the local NAACP orchestrated a remarkably savvy campaign against the discriminatory hiring policies of a clothing factory that was located in the Charleston Navy Yard. Only 1 month after the United States officially entered World War I, factory officials announced plans to employ only white women for 600 new openings. Outrage gripped the African American community, which immediately declared its intention to test the clothing factory's hiring policy in court. To begin the process of collecting evidence for a legal case, six unidentified black women requested clothing factory applications at the Naval Yard, at the post office, and at the office of the recorder. Light enough to pass for white, the fair-skinned women received applications for work, but their darker complexion sisters, comrades, were turned away. If the white community expected African-Americans to take this latest racial slight in silence, it was in for a rude awakening. Something on the order of a political revival struck Black Charleston, as an emerging class of new Negro women and men aggressively pursued their quest for full access to the labor market, and by extension, the material comforts and the leisure pleasures of the good life. Unfolding protests over the clothing factory's hiring policy brought to the fore political issues that were consumed in the NAACP for more than a decade. The position of African Americans in the political economy, the political potential of black workers' growing consumption power, and the necessity of addressing regional fragmentation and difference within the imagined black national community. Front and center in this developing drama, the Charleston NAACP assumed a visible role in this hiring dispute. The branch's local secretary and most outspoken leader, Richard M. Mickey, viewed the hiring controversy as an opportunity to widen black women's employment opportunities, as well as galvanize various segments of the African American community. Significantly, Mickey was hardly alone in his concern about the subordinate position of black women in the capitalist economy. A major issue in the wartime South was the continued marginality of African American female wage earners. Of the opinion that diversification of black women's employment options advanced the larger goals of the race, Richard Mickey looked favorably upon women fortunate enough to secure non-domestic work. Wasting no time in aligning the NAACP with the cause of African American workers, Mickey hurriedly committed the organization's resources to defending black women's rights to the same employment opportunities as their white counterparts. Over the course of their dispute with the clothing factory, local blacks received critical advice and legal counsel from the always dependable tandem of Johnson and Du Bois, the NAACP's executive secretary, Roy Nash, the Charleston-born D.C.-based lawyer, Archibald Rimke. They would also receive assistance from African-American civil rights leaders in Minnesota. In Minnesota, for example, African-American leaders, white leaders in the NAACP, as well as African-Americans, would actually petition Congress for assistance in intervening in what was going on in Charleston. And in many ways, this demonstrates these sort of transnational, transregional networks. Interestingly enough, oftentimes, the World War I period is often presented, the 1920s, is often presented as this period in which African Americans, and particularly the NAACP, was not engaged in labor disputes. But what we see in Charleston and what we see in other places is that the NAACP was very much engaged in labor issues. In Key West, Florida, for example, with an African American who's involved in the International Longshoremen's Association, is brutally attacked by a white worker. This African-American worker does not go to the ILA. First organization that he calls is the NAACP. First person that he calls is James Weldon Johnson, who intervenes on behalf of this worker and who also petitions the ILA for assistance in dealing with the question of workers' brutality, dealing with the question of wages. So this notion that the NAACP is sort of divorced from the concerns of black workers is very problematic when you begin to engage the literature, when you begin to engage the branch files. And I think when we think about African-American historiography, I think we still have to begin to engage these files, engage this literature, and rethink the ways in which we discuss not only issues of black nationalism, but also how we discuss the black left. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the issue of politics and the NAACP in the South. I also wanted to talk a little bit more about education, but since I am faced with time constraints, I'm just going to briefly sum up a few things. In the 1920s, the NAACP is not only engaged in sort of labor issues, but they're also very much engaged in political issues. In 1920, for example, the NAACP at the national and the local level works extremely hard to increase the black electorate. In places like Birmingham, in places like Jacksonville, in places like Atlanta, Georgia, politically, the NAACP is not only working to increase the black electorate, but they're also working to sort of change the ways in which African Americans view the political process. In Alabama, for example, African Americans who are affiliated with the NAACP form citizenship classes. And many of the classes that you begin to see that we know about when we think about the 1960s have their roots in the 1920s. In the 1920s, we also begin to see the NAACP engaging important work in terms of beginning to develop leadership training classes among young African Americans. We also begin to see the NAACP building branches in the South, particularly among black and historically black colleges. So this notion that the NAACP is somehow divorced from the folk is very problematic. And one of the reasons that's very problematic is because this criticism of the NAACP comes from people like Cyril Griggs and A. Philip Randolph, whose credentials with the folk in the 1920s ain't really good. So this is very important too, because as we begin to sort of talk about the NAACP and this question of its lack of a radical tradition, we need to also begin to sort of engage the credentials of folks who lodged that particular critique. Rather than attempt to finish this paper, which I can, I want to end with an interesting quote from W.B. Du Bois. And there's so much that I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about the NAACP, not just in politics, but in 1927, for example, the NAACP plays a critical role in the Hamilton strike, a strike led by college students in Hamilton, where they are fighting against the sort of authoritarian policies of schools administration. And when so many organizations would not support college students who were basically attempting to democratize higher education, so often we talk about just sort of segregation. But key in terms of the struggle of the NAACP, especially when you think about the 1920s, is the critical role that people like Du Bois and people like James Weldon Johnson and Marvel Jackson and the crisis would play in terms of supporting black students who were attempting to democratize black higher education. Would love to talk about that. But I'm going to end with a quote from W.B. Du Bois. And he's basically having this conversation with James Weldon Johnson. And it's in 1929, at the 1929 NAACP convention. And he tells James Weldon Johnson, he says, the significance of what we have done is not so much the advancement made as the foundation that we have begun to lay. It is my hope that this panel and this symposium not only builds upon the foundation and the political foundation that's so rich in blood and sweat and tears of our ancestors, but then it also raises the necessary questions in order for us to create a better world for yet unborn. So thank you for your attention. stand up for about 2 minutes.